Hi, this is Alan Chartek, and I'm delighted to be in conversation with Paula DiPerna, a strategic environmental and philanthropic policy advisor and writer. She serves currently as Special Advisor North America for the Carbon Disclosure Project, CDP. She also serves as a strategic advisor to the Intellectual Property Exchange International. In addition, Ms. DiPerna is a member of the Board of Advisors of the NTR Foundation, a global energy and environmental foundation with headquarters in Dublin, Ireland, and boy, am I jealous of that, and Global Kids based in New York City, whose mission is to develop a global citizenship. She also serves on the Circle of Advisors of Rachel's Network, which links women philanthropists who have environmental interests. Ms. DiPerna served formerly as president of the International Division of the Chicago Climate Exchange, a private company that pioneered emissions trading worldwide with special responsibility for small places like China, India, and Korea, and other emerging markets. DiPerna also served formerly as president of the Joyce Foundation, a major public policy philanthropy known for innovation, executive vice president for recruitment and public policy of CCX, and vice president for international affairs for the Cousteau Society, whose principal was oceans pioneer Jacques-Yves Cousteau. As president of the Joyce Foundation, Ms. DiPerna oversaw all grant-making and operations representing roughly $40 million in annual philanthropy. As vice president for international affairs at the Cousteau Society, Ms. DiPerna was responsible for all aspects of national and international environmental policy and interacted extensively with the U.S. Congress, heads of state, and the United Nations. While at the Cousteau Society from 1979 to 1997, Ms. DiPerna also wrote and co-produced a dozen Cousteau documentary films. She has traveled extensively globally with Cousteau teams and lived for 1 year in the Amazon region of Brazil, Colombia, and Peru, where she oversaw and planned expedition activities. DiPerna has also served as a consultant on environmental matters to the World Bank, the Global Environmental Facility, and LEED International. Among other organizations, in 2001, Ms. DiPerna also founded the Jobs and Environment Initiative, which quantifies job creation benefits of environmental activities. Nationally and in various U.S. states, DiPerna was a candidate for the U.S. Congress in 1992. DiPerna is a frequent speaker and panelist. She's widely published in magazines and newspapers and the author of a novel and several nonfiction books. She became a touchstone of environmental epidemiology. She is a contributor and columnist for www.forbes.com/worldview, www.womensnews.org, and www.wealthasia.net. Ms. DiPerna was an Eisenhower Fellow in 1998 and spent time in Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic studying emerging environmental policy in Central Europe. She's a member of the Women's Forum of New York and the Council of Foreign Relations. Ms. DiPerna is based in New York City. Welcome, Paula DiPerna.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, that's quite a history you've got here. May I call you Paula?
Certainly.
Okay. So, Paula, if it's okay with you, let's start at the beginning. With all of that behind you, where did it all start? Where were you born? Who were your parents? What were they doing? How'd you become so successful?
Well, success is all relative. I guess, you know, I was born in New York City in Pelham Bay in the Bronx. I thought Pete Moss was a person. I used to visit my Aunt Rose used to bring me up to Peekskill, New York on the weekends. And, you know, the environment for me was Valhalla Dam and the Hutchinson River Parkway. So I can't say that I came into environmental interests other than accidentally. And looking back on it, you know, I think I do a lot of teaching and I talk to students a lot. And, you know, in today's world where everybody is presumed to be entrepreneurial material and reinventing one's life and being an entrepreneur and individualism, all of that is very much worshipped. What I say to students is look, you know, life doesn't, nothing in, nothing out, garbage in, garbage out. It takes a lot to get something out of life. And you have to work at it. But it doesn't mean you have to give up fun. I love fun. And so I was very lucky. I started writing. I was teaching. I got laid off. I was one of that generation of public school teachers that was basically tossed into the trash in the 1970s in the New York City fiscal crisis. And I often wonder what would have happened if the New York City Board of Ed came back looking for us. You know, a whole generation of well-trained, very dedicated, very committed teachers was just laid off because of the budget crisis, and we all went about our business. And we went into a million probably other things and left a big vacuum, really, in the teacher structure. So what I did, I started covering public schools for the Village Voice. I got a professor, introduced me to an editor who then gave me an assignment. I blew it. He didn't take the piece. I said, can I rewrite it? He said, sure, if you want to. I rewrote it. He loved it. I got published. So there I was, a writer. And I thought, well, that's great. I got one article under my belt. I'll get two. I'll get three. And you just keep on, you know, trying. And then I volunteered to work for Jacques Cousteau. And we hit it off. And I worked on a book with them. And
Wait a second, Paul. How do you just say that? I mean, how do you get to just have a conversation with Jacques Cousteau?
Well, there again, it's all very serendipitous. A friend of mine gave me a Christmas present, which was a membership in the Cousteau Society. Now, I was writing about public schools. I always wanted to write fiction. I knew nothing really about Cousteau, but I knew I was getting interested in covering journalism, rather science, writing about science. There was a lot of new technology, the computer age. All these things were starting to happen. There were a lot of new publications covering science. So I thought, well, okay, so I get this Christmas present. And included in the present, the membership of the Cousteau Society, which is an environmental organization like any other, was an ad saying Captain Cousteau has a contract to publish a book with Doubleday called The Cousteau Almanac, and volunteer editors and writers are needed. So I was by then a writer, so I volunteered. And the truth is that we did the book, and I wrote my first piece about climate change in 1979. You know, people don't understand how old this problem is in terms of, you know, when people started to notice it. And so that's how I got into the Cousteau Society, was by volunteering. And then the next day, I got this call from a very wonderful writer and colleague named Mose Richards, who at that point was the editor of the book. And he said, look, we have a budget for one paid staff writer, and we want to offer you the job. So that's how I got the job.
Had you applied for any job?
No, I have volunteered. So they offered me a job the next day, and that was it. The rest was history. That changed my life right
then. How did it pay?
I think I got paid $150 a week.
And but, of course, $150 then was not $150 then.
Certainly not. But, you know, we had this big contract from Doubleday, and I think I wrote myself about 50 articles for that book. I did a lot of editing. It was a fantastic project.
What was Jacques Cousteau really like?
Well, he was very much like what you saw on TV. You know, people don't realize that, we talk about going viral. Well, Cousteau, on any given night in his heyday, 200 million people worldwide were watching the same television show. And one of his geniuses was he figured out that people wanted to recognize him. They needed to, you know, you had to have standardization. So you always saw the ship. You always saw the red cap. You always saw some kind of equipment. And you always saw him. And you always saw him wearing the same clothes, and he almost always carried himself in the same way. But in terms of what he was really like, he was an absolute gentleman. He was charming. He was generous. He was very, very childlike, and he had an amazing amount of curiosity.
When you say childlike, what do you mean?
Well, he didn't really discipline himself very much. I mean, he went after what he wanted to go after, and he had a certain innocence, a certain questioning nature that I consider to be, you know, the gift that children have, where they're so creatively interested in the world, and that's what he brought. And he instilled that in us all the time, and he never chastised anybody. One of the great stories I can tell about Cousteau was, you know, he used to carry his own bags. And I never saw him ever, you know, he always had a briefcase and a small bag, and his hands were full. And invariably, people would stop him on the sidewalk and say, oh, can I just shake your hand? I just want to thank you. He'd always put his bags down, stop, shake the hand. You know, he never, ever pulled rank or showed off, and there were many a time that, I gave him a roll of toilet paper and a bottle of orange juice, and I said, that's all there is tonight. And he just was one of the guys that was in Haiti, and, you know, we had a great time together. And he was also an incredibly visionary person. Thanks to him, and largely I would like to say thanks to me, Antarctica, which we don't even talk about very much anymore, was taken off the table in 1989 when there was a push to go after the oil and the gas and the manganese and God knows what else would be there, mineral resources in Antarctica. There was a movement to go after those. And there was a diplomatic initiative called the Wellington Convention that was going to permit that exploitation under, quote, safe circumstances. So right about then, the Exxon Valdez went aground, and Cousteau and I were flying, I forget where, probably to Cuba or back and forth from Cuba, where we had done an expedition. And Cousteau tears an article out of the paper, hands it to me about the Wellington Convention, says, this can't go on. We have to stop this. So we kicked in with a very high-level lobbying campaign with George Bush 1 and François Mitterrand. And the net of that was that Antarctica, no mineral exploitation was permitted for 50 years. So most people don't realize, and if you Google search this, it won't come up in the top 10, that there is a moratorium on mineral and oil exploitation in Antarctica for 50 years as of 1989, which, by the way, could be done in the Arctic today as well and probably should be. So what's the big deal? Okay, the Antarctic, as Cousteau would put it, was the center of cold. And if you started going after oil and minerals and digging it up and putting dirt on the ice, you get the albedo effect and the ice melting. And of course, that's happening now, but it would have been much more accelerated if there had been exploitation in Antarctica, separate and apart from, you know, spills and other things that could have compromised wildlife. So he was always thinking ahead. He had a sense, a common sense of where environmental issues would go. And his great gift was that he could communicate it. And, you know, probably the field of marine biology was created, really, by his enthusiasm.
I know a young man who I like very much and respect very much who, you know, went into that field, you know, marine biology. And there aren't that many jobs working for the good guys. You know, when people go into environmental science or other things, sure, there are a lot of majors now, but, you know, who can they work for? A major corporation with two letters? Do you ever have any insight into how we use the people who learn this stuff?
Well, I mean, I think you have to go into the whole basis of the economy, which is, you know, basically dumbing itself down all the time. I mean, the role of science in society, which is paramount, and we're not emphasizing science education. So obviously there are fewer and fewer jobs, and even people who work for corporations. The whole spin that everything is to be monetized, everything is about branding. Science is not for public good, but for some product development. And this is insane, and it's really going in the wrong direction. So if you're a marine biologist, whereas you used to go out in the field and you used to acquire knowledge and you used to try to apply that knowledge to some greater public purpose, now you basically are assigned to count this species and that species for commercial exploitation, and should there be a fishing moratorium, and shouldn't there be? And of course, all of that's very important. But the basic premise of gathering knowledge for the greater use of humanity, that I think is not sufficiently emphasized. And the economy is, in my opinion, just based on doodad development. And as long as we're based on doodad development, I don't think science is going to be an attractive profession.
I need a little definition on doodads.
Doodads. Doodads are things you don't need. Mm-hmm. And I have a premise that most of our economic effort and most of our time is spent doing things that basically we don't need to be doing. And what do I mean by that? Okay, so, you know, much of what we're doing, the sharing economy, the rewriting, the rehashing, the discussing of what happened yesterday, digital technology that enables connections and, you know, connections among people that probably would have been connected some other way. So I always wonder why we're not having productivity and economic growth. My opinion is we're just dumbing down time, and that 90% of our time is spent on things that we don't need to be spending the time on.
You ran for Congress, Paula, and you did that. We're talking to Paula DiPerna, by the way. You ran for Congress. Here you are writing about environment, writing about doing incredible things with your life, and you decided to run against the Republican in an area where you would have had an uphill push?
Well,
that's a question.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, I mean, I felt, first of all, my mother, if you want to go back to you know, to people's, what stimulates people. My mother was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. She worked every year at the Board of Elections.
In
New York City. She wrote letters to Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt. She was my mother was sort of born to rectify, is what I always think. And
you got that from her, honestly.
I got a little bit of it from her. And I think she would have liked to have been in politics, but and one of the things I admire honestly about you, Alan, I mean, I think politics is a very worthy profession. I think it's one of the most important things that people can spend time on. And I also think that while we blame campaign finance and money and politics for the corruption of politics, we could solve that problem if we just flooded the pipeline with candidates. If everybody decided to run for something and there were so many good candidates, money would be irrelevant. Money would be crowded out because we'd all be running and finding, other ways of getting our messages out through our networks that, you don't really have to have a lot of money to use, certainly not these days with social media. But anyway, back to my campaign, and this ties in again to the Paris Climate Summit, which just occurred, where I also was. I was with Cousteau in 1992 at the Earth Summit, which was the precursor of what we just lived through in Paris. They call it COP21 in Paris, meaning the 21st Conference of the Parties. Well, they didn't actually start numbering those conferences at the beginning, but it was 92 when that Framework Convention on Climate Change was signed. And I was with Cousteau. The UN system, you get a series of, they have a different hierarchy of passes. If you were a president or a head of state, and then, just as in Paris, all the presidents and heads of state went to Rio to ostensibly grab onto environmental problems and take them in hand, Cousteau had an all-area pass, which was the equivalent of a head of state. And a head of state could have the all-area pass plus a pass for one chief of staff, which was me. So Cousteau and I were like on the innermost sanctum. The only people around us were presidents. They were like dear flies in your hair. You couldn't really get presidents out of your hair, out of your way.
Like who?
Well, Fidel Castro, Boutros Ghali, president of France at the time. I guess that was Mitterrand. Brundtland, I was in the elevator, was Brundtland from Norway, Fidel Castro, Cousteau, me, George Bush. I don't think it was Mrs. Thatcher, but I forget who was the Prime Minister of England. But anyone who was anybody, whoever was running the world was there. And we were at a reception, and one by one, these presidents came up. Everybody wanted to meet Cousteau. I never met anybody who didn't want to meet Cousteau. So we were drinking champagne, celebrating that this climate change convention had been signed. And by the way, we went to the White House, and I think Cousteau was quite instrumental in getting Bush to even go to Rio, let alone sign the thing. So there were all the presidents, and they all said, "Now, Captain Cousteau, aren't you happy that we have heard your message? And don't you think this is great that we've signed this thing? Now, if we can only do something." And almost to a man, and they were almost all were men, kept saying, "Now, if we can only do something, if we only can do something, we'd only do something." I said to Cousteau, "Like, if they can't do it, who can do it? I mean, what are they saying? If only we could do something." And then there was a photograph, and they were supposed to all get into this group photograph. And here all these presidents, with all their power, they were like very fluid at the cocktail party, and they seemed to be in charge of their bodies and themselves and everything. They get to the photo shoot, and they don't know where to stand. Nobody has given them instructions of where to stand. So who comes out but the secretaries? All these young Brazilian girls with 8.5 by 11 typing paper. And they write down on the typing paper the names of the countries, and they lay it out alphabetically. And every president, like a little cat, a little mouse, goes right to the typing paper and stands on it and becomes this rigid character who had to be told where to stand. And all that power disappeared. They just froze up into caricatures of themselves who couldn't even make the decision really of where to stand. And I said to myself, there's something wrong with this picture. So I came back to Cooperstown, where I also at that point was involved with local politics and local environmental issues. And there was a Republican incumbent who'd been in office for 6 terms. I think he was into his 5th term. He had a pretty good record on environment. He hadn't really accomplished anything particularly notable.
He was sort of, as my mom would have said, the best of that class.
He was the best of the class, but I didn't think he needed a pass. I thought, why should he have a free pass?
Sure.
Why should there not be an opponent? And it was also an interesting year. It was the year of the woman, so-called. It was a 5-way race. There were a couple of wild cards. And I thought, here's a chance to put your money where your mouth is. Why don't you try to see what it is actually about running for Congress? And I had, it was one of the greatest things I ever did. At that point, the congressional district, the 23rd, Cooperstown was right in the middle of it. So I could get home every night. I never had to sleep. And I slept in my own bed. Friends made me these energy muffins. I had a freezer full of them. I grabbed one in the morning, go out. And little by little, I built up a campaign system. I spent $30,000 in cash. I had about $75,000 in kind donated by the Democratic Congressional Committee. And I got a third of the vote.
That's
so
pretty good.
It was pretty good. And, I would definitely consider doing it again if there was, as Bella Abzug once told me, "Paula, you got to have a race." So right now, I don't know what the race would be, but I recommend it to anybody who has a frustration with the system. Just run, see what it's like.
So Paula DiPerna, you just mention Bella Abzug. I knew her a little bit. She could be very aggressive, of course, and she would push people around. I remember she went, I saw her one time, I was walking into the Democratic Convention. She was right ahead of me, and the cop said, "Identification, please," to her. And she said, "You know damn well who I am."
Be like that.
Do you see yourself as a Bella Abzug type?
No, I'm more of a, well, I like to think I'm more of a pussycat than she might have been, although she had her pussycat side, I must say. No, I think that it's difficult, especially if you're a woman, to be present and be aggressive in the best sense of that word without having to accommodate some impressions of how far is appropriate to go. And I think if you have ideas and you want to put them into the system somehow, you've got to step out. And, you know, Bella wore a hat because she said the judges, when she was one of the first women to be a lawyer. I think she was the first woman to graduate from Columbia Law School. So she wore a hat in court because the judges didn't notice her. They thought she was some, like, assistant. And so she became known for the hat. But she was also at Rio. And her great gift was training other women to read the documents, to read those documents, those negotiation documents, to become familiar with how UN process works. That's what her whole idea was, so that those women would then go back to all the countries in the world and become political. Learn about negotiations, not fear power, not fear authority. Learn to question authority in a constructive manner. And for her, given her legal training, it was all about learning to read the documents. And, you know, just again, we just lived through the Paris Climate Summit. Instead of having what we had in Rio, which was an enormous number of documents, there's one document, 30 pages. And I had, to some extent, some role in that process.
Well, what was the role? Don't skip that easily, Paula.
Well, so one of the things that I'm working on now is the degree to which the economy is already greening, that, you know, Wall Street is waking up to the fact that the economy has to tilt away from high carbon, high greenhouse gas activities. And that doesn't only mean that we're going to need renewable energy and we can bring a lot of renewables online quicker. What it means is that the ordinary companies that are, let's say, in the S&P 500 that make all kinds of things, speaking of S&P 500, they've launched recently something called the Carbon Efficient Index, which overweights companies that are highly efficient in their use of fossil fuels and have least amount of carbon emissions, and underweights the ones that are more polluting. And that carbon efficient index is tracking to a T with the S&P 500. Now, what that means is there's no economic penalty to a company if it favors efficiency and if it pushes inefficiency. That's a big deal. That's a benchmark economic indicator, which would suggest that there's much more greening of the economy going on where it matters.
Why?
Well, first of all, it's an inevitable.
Can't beat them, join them sort of thing?
Kind of, you can't beat them, join them, because the risks involved are so significant with regard to extreme weather events, with regard to inability to predict supply chains, with regard to drought, with regard to tempestuous rains, with regard to flooding, that no matter what your business, you have got to be aware of all those risks, and you've got to hedge against them. Now, how do you hedge against them? You eliminate them is the one thing you can do, is start not putting yourself, you know, understand where your supply chains are vulnerable, move them. If you're a pharmaceutical company, you have to pre-position drugs. You've got to know, okay, we may need these drugs in a particular place, and it's going to be monsoon season. We better get them there earlier. And the economy is beginning to reward companies that don't suffer these kinds of dramatic losses. Also, there's something called the 1 in 100 initiative, which is a consortium of insurance companies and others who are concerned about catastrophic events. And their theory is that, you know, like a Hurricane Sandy, you know, 1 in 100 year event is going to start happening maybe once every 40 years. Now, that's an insolvency event, a 1 in 100. If you're getting a 1 in 100 every 40 or every 20 years, you're going to have insolvencies that you never expected.
And when you say insolvency,
companies go out of business. Yeah. They die and they can't recover, let's say. So you have a lot of greening of the economy going on at the basic level. And then you have a lot of new products. You have funds where people invest precisely in clean energy companies or companies that are inventing, let's say, a lot of this environmental stuff is not glamorous. You know, we think about organic food or we think about electric cars. All these things are glamorous. You know, like United Technologies or General Motors or Bosch, they make stuff that goes inside refrigerators. Well, one of the things that saves a lot of energy is something called a frost-free membrane, which is just a little device that if you keep on improving it, you remove the amount of frost that builds up in a refrigerator, you save a lot of energy. These are things no one even sees. First of all, they have to be made. Secondly, they have to be designed. They have to be designed first, then made, fabricated, installed, shipped. So the people are beginning to realize that there is a future. There's a whole reindustrialization that can go on if we just embrace the problem of climate change and try to address it. So in the Paris conference, I gave a couple of talks about this, about the waking up of Wall Street. And, you know, I know all the people who participated and who led. I mean, there's nobody greater really in dedication than Christiana Figueres, who was the head of the UN, still is the head. John Kerry, unbelievable amount of diplomacy he applied. President Obama, President of France, again, all the heads of state, they signed this thing. It's a unanimous agreement. But if you read it, there's very little that's in it that wasn't in the 1992 agreement, down to the same words. So you have to ask yourself, what has happened to the last 30 years of discussion about climate change? And why is it that now in COP21 in the year 2015, we're celebrating as if we hadn't known all of this before?
Are we doomed, Paula?
No, I don't think we're doomed. But one of the things we have to start to remember is memory, that we're losing our institutional memory, going back to the science, study of science. People want to, again, going back to the whole culture, everyone wants to start something new and reinvent, be a first mover. And on climate change, it's really about second and third movers. It's not about first movers. There's almost nothing new to invent when it comes to climate change. If there is, we can wait for it. What we need to be doing is making things bringing to scale the things we already know how to do. And let's just take infrastructure. You know, I was driving over here from Cooperstown. I mean, I don't know when the last time you drove on Route 20 was. Mm. But people should be ashamed. Leaders should be ashamed. Going back to running for Congress, I would be ashamed to be the president or the head of a governor of a state where the roads are in certain conditions that our roads are in. I would be ashamed. If the best thing I could have is Amtrak, now I take Amtrak all the time and I know how hard those people work, but it's shameful that our country has a railroad that is in that dilapidated state. And one could go on and on. I take Metro North, the electric poles are falling down. We are one big storm away from a complete blackout, it would look like, if you looked at the poles on the railroad track. So where is the idea to take infrastructure, build it up, make it resilient, put better drainage. Let's just talk about very simple things like drainage on Route 20. If you put massive, sophisticated system of drainage on Route 20, you wouldn't have all this buckling. And that would put a lot of people to work. I mean, you know, that's like the whole idea of reindustrializing with an eye towards tempestuous climate change, which is underway.
And how come we don't do it?
Well, I don't think we do it because we have a lot of silos still. We have a total absence of leadership. And one of the things that you really have is too much specialization and not enough blue-collar approach to this. I mean, you know, a lot of jobs that can address climate change are in the manufacturing sector. There was a time when the only growth in employment in manufacturing was among green industries, welders and people like that who had to make catalytic converters and things of that nature. So people are still in their very specialized kind of abstract view when it comes to environment, and we haven't brought it down to earth, and we haven't brought it down to the jobs level. I mean, it's the biggest jobs program in modern history to go after climate change. And why aren't we doing it is because I don't think we're connecting the dots. We're running on empty. You know, people say there's no money in the budget, no job training money. We've got to put people into certain kinds of job training, accelerate, you know, all of that. And it just takes leadership, really.
Well, that's right. I agree with that. You ran as a Democrat.
Right.
And my question to you would be, is the Republican class now, the emerging Republican class, which seems to me to be getting more and more right wing all the time, are they the ones who are just saying, listen, I don't give a damn about my kids or what's going to be here for my grandchildren, but profit is everything. Is that a reasonable explanation of what's going on?
Well, no, I don't think that's what's going on. I think what's going on is nothing but theater. I think that we have so completely genre blurred our society, so nobody knows really when truth begins and docudrama, you know, docudrama is an example, infomercials are an example. The public has a complete right to be confused about what people say. So when people talk about the absence of information on climate change, it's only theater because they couldn't possibly actually believe that they don't care about it. I don't believe that even the candidates I dislike the most don't care about their children. I mean, clearly something has happened in the way you present yourself as a candidate that requires you to outact the other one and unreasonable
Paula,
things.
Let me argue with you.
All right, in terms
of the distinction, I don't get it. You get a person who says, we're not going to do anything about climate change. Often they're Republicans. It would be helpful to our opponent, the president of the United States, for example. It would be helpful to get rid of them. So we'll adopt this. But they do have grandchildren. And, you know, we do know what's coming. The ice caps are melting, as you lecture all of us and know about. And so it seems to me it's the most crass type of behavior.
Well, it's very crass, but I think it's fundamentally tied into winning at all costs.
That's right.
And that in some warped way, the theory is that if I win, I'll fix it then.
Really?
But let me get in first.
Really?
And that's the only thing I can think of over and above this theatrical. I mean, people like theater. We all like theater, but I don't like it in politics. And, you know, we have failed to really redraw our boundaries so that people who run for office understand that it's not a stage.
Well, yes, there are two kinds of things. There's policy and then there's politics. We know that. You are a person who has practiced both. But basically, you're respected worldwide because of your analytic ability, because of what you know. And policy is something different. They can go into the cloakroom in the Senate and say, oh, my God, this is terrible what we're doing out there, the acting. But they still do it, don't they?
They still do it, and I think it's part of the cycle of reward that we've created. You know, polling numbers, free media, you know,
sure. It
makes me laugh when people say, oh, so-and-so is getting so much free media. Well, who's giving it to him? It's the media giving it to him. So that it's like you become a story about yourself, which is part, again, of a certain narcissism that we're all so locked into, is that people like to, you know, talk about what they talk about and talk about it again and again to each other and to everybody they can get their hands on. So there's a certain narcissism involved, too, in this political dialogue. But, you know, one of the things that I feel lucky about, and I wish, you know, more people could experience, you know, there's a huge amount of capacity in Congress. The staffs are generally very well trained. When you go in there to work on an issue, I'm one of the people who says lobbying is not all bad. You know, there's such a thing as lobbying for good things. With Cousteau, we lobbied to get the president to go to Rio. We lobbied to get Antarctica off limits. We lobbied to get Alaska protection. We lobbied for the Clean Air Act. You go in and you make your case.
Yeah, but that's all offset, Paula, by K Street and the immense amount of greedy lobbyists who are outspending the good guys by many, many multiples.
Well, that's, again, everything has tipped out of balance. When things are in balance, again, you can crowd out K Street with quality. I mean, I may be naive, but I think going in to make a pitch to somebody who's reasonable, you have a reasonable story, you tell them the upside. Every story has an upside and a downside. And from a political perspective, who cared about Antarctica? What did we win on when we were lobbying for that? Not on the whales and on the penguins and that we need to save it, and not on climate change. We made the point that if nobody can go after those minerals, no country on earth is going after them, it's good for American business. Secondly, because there'd be no competition. There would be no reason to be competing. Companies wouldn't have to compete with other countries if nobody could go after those minerals, one. Two, the price for those minerals at that time was extremely low. So what was the purpose of going after them? Nobody actually even wanted to go. There wasn't a groundswell of companies who wanted to go to Antarctica. There was just this kind of knee-jerk idea that, well, if it's there, we should be able to go after it. So we were able to construct a very counterintuitive argument that went to very basic self-interest, and we were able to prevail because even Republicans, and I must say more Republicans even than Democrats, got that message. When the Exxon Valdez ran aground and all, you know, those otters were having their fur cleaned with Dawn detergent and having their eyes brushed out with toothbrushes by volunteers, I remember Cousteau himself wasn't really upset, you know, and we made a film up there with Jean-Michel Cousteau's son. But Cousteau himself, you know, there had been oil spills in Europe, and he was a bit indifferent to it. And I said, how come you're not upset about this? He said, you know what the real crime is? I said, what? He said, taking the oil out of the ground at today's price. Now, when you go back to the Alaska pipeline, we were supposed to use the oil from the Alaska pipeline to bridge from fossil fuels to renewables, which we did not do. We wasted all that oil. We did not make the bridge to renewables. So now we're scrounging around like we just heard about renewables, relatively speaking. And the same is true with hydrofracking. I mean, on what kind of philosophical or practical basis can you possibly justify taking water, which is the rarest and most precious thing on Earth, that there'll never be another drop? How can you justify shooting it full of chemicals, then shooting that toxic water into the ground, blowing up the ground to release gas, and then waste the gas? Where we have no energy efficiency programs, we have no requirements to use the gas efficiently, we have no plans to use it efficiently. So we are compromising water, we're compromising the aquifers, Cooperstown, most people live on their wells. All it would take is one spill underground, and that's the end of the water in Cooperstown. And that's true throughout. And thank you, Governor Cuomo, for the foresight to hold off on hydrofracking in New York State. I think that will go down in history as one of the great things that, the governor was able to do. But just beyond New York State, how can we possibly as a society justify putting our water at risk for the sake of wasting energy? That is what we are creating. Now, so back to lobbying, I think when you start putting things that way, you tap into latent economic self-interest. Now, when you're starting to talk to crazies, of whom there are some now in Congress, then you can't do anything. Then you just have to assume that, you know, you have to fight craziness with craziness, and you just go to a maximum and you adopt a few theatrical things, I guess, yourself. But I still believe in reason. I think that we can still save the society and have a good time and have equity with reason.
Paula, you have worked with the UN. What's that like? I mean, you know, we've all grown up together hearing people say that the UN isn't much, could be a lot better than it is. It's like a meandering stream. What?
Well, the UN, you know, it's a beautiful place. Two things about the UN that strike me. One, it's the only place in the world where, one, everybody's voice does matter from a point of view of geopolitics. Every nation gets to vote. Cultures matter. And it is supposedly the center for peace. You know, that it, if the UN really were able to double down and focus most of its resources on peacekeeping, peacemaking, maybe it should get out of some of these ancillary businesses. Maybe we don't need all these agencies that have really been spawned by bureaucracy, and the UN could narrow itself back to peace. But, you know, in some ways, it's mind-numbing. I think of it as a passion-extinguishing machine. You go into the UN, you're all hopped up about an issue. You spend a little time in the UN, you come out exhausted because the negotiations, it's tedious. It's very tedious. But maybe that plays a role, that you have to keep sculpting out the point and sculpting out the point and gathering consensus until you have unanimity. And by definition, then everyone agrees. Now, problematically, let's say take the Paris outcome. Yes, indeed, it was unanimous. Yes, indeed, it's the first time there's been a unanimous agreement to act on climate change all at the same time. Rio had unanimity, but there was a differentiation between the developing and developed countries and who got started first. So now we have unanimity, but at what price? I mean, the outcome of Paris is kind of a grab bag. You have 160 plus national blueprints for addressing climate change that have different starting points. They have different methodologies, different targets. So, you know, it's like, who's going to look at the report card? And this is an open question. And the only people who really could look at the report card is the UN. So the UN is one of those things that has, just like Congress, we've kind of, back to what I said earlier, we're kind of running on vapors. We haven't renewed our institutions, really. We haven't updated our institutions for the 21st century. And that is a crisis, I think.
Are you optimistic?
Funnily enough, I am. Because, first of all, I wouldn't get up in the morning. I think we're all programmed to deny. And, you know, big problems, we tend to want to sugarcoat them just to keep going. But I am optimistic because I think that knowledge is out there. And I just think we're going through a really bad patch of confusion, that we seem to be in a period of aggrandizing violence, aggrandizing vulgarity. We're sort of in a slightly decadent time. But I think it'll pass. And I think we'll have a rebirth of, people talk about the millennials as if they were some kinds of gods and goddesses, you know, that they're going to have like a kind of a moment of great resurrection of thought. And I think that could be true.
Any evidence?
Well, back to investment, back to what we were saying earlier, one of the reasons that there's this greening of the economy going on is, if you talk to people who invest money, they have a lot of client demand for these greener instruments, the greener funds, the investment in clean technology from millennials. It's either the money of millennials, you know, a lot of people have made a lot of money and they want it invested in a certain way. I also think the evidence of sharing family responsibilities, advances in identity, you know, gay rights and so on, all of this would suggest a tendency to fairness. And I think that's the evidence of a reason to be optimistic. We just, again, need to refresh the institutions, because if we don't have institutions that people have confidence in, it's a road warrior society. We could be in a road warrior situation in the next 10 years, I think, if our institutions aren't brought up to speed. And, you know, we have infrastructure issues, that's physical infrastructure, the roads and not whatnot, but we also have intellectual infrastructure problems where we don't really have systems that people know how to use or want to use or believe in. And in that kind of situation, it's very easy, one, to trash the institutions. Two, it's very easy for people to be, as we discussed earlier, theatrical and go over the top in their criticism of those institutions because we don't have any natural stake in them anymore.
Well, that does raise an interesting question, Paula, if I may say, and we, We're talking and in conversation with Paula DiPerna, strategic, environmental, and philanthropic policy advisor and a writer. And she has advised so many major groups that I'm not even going to start. You'll have to go back to the beginning of the program to hear all of these wonderful accomplishments that she's had. But you just mentioned the sort of, at least I thought I heard, the academic infrastructure of the country. Now, I was a professor for 40 years and had a sense that some of the things that kids were getting in college were not what the society really needed. It wasn't rigorous enough, wasn't scientific enough. It was the tenure system leads to, and I had it, of course, I'm not complaining, but it had, you know, a side effect which wasn't healthy, which was that, okay, this is occupation for life, and I don't really have to change with the needs of the times or the society. What do you think?
Well, I think that that's a risk, and we all get complacent. So what's the antidote to complacency? It's normal to be complacent, but that's where leadership comes in. I'm sure you had a dean or somebody who came around and said, hey, Alan, you know, sharpen it up. Now, if you didn't have somebody...
Never.
Okay, well, then somebody needs to sharpen that person up. But, you know, that's why hierarchies are important. You know, this is a myth that society is flat, that, you know, flat decision-making, flat consensus decision-making. Consensus decision-making has a role, but it just takes you in a circle. At some point, somebody needs to say, Alan, why are you teaching the same old stuff over and over again? And I think, you know, we're going into a situation of lack of control where you have a great deal of off-site learning. You have, you know, digital classes. Everything is fine. Anything goes. I think that it all comes back to that basic problem of people not being, one, interested enough in their own lives, so they don't know how to infuse passion into the system. And so the system kind of becomes complacent. And I'll even go further. I think the fact that we can experience thrills now so easily, you go online and you can do anything, you can go anywhere virtually, life is kind of becoming dull for people. People are inventing things every day because they're getting bored. And if I think we're generally too bored for our own good, and that has created a certain complacency, which then seeps into all kinds of institutions. So tenure per se, I don't think is the problem. What were the roots of tenure? It was academic freedom. If it became abused, there's a reason. There's a reason if tenure becomes abused that is not tied into its original premise.
Agreed. I have almost never seen tenure used for the right reasons. As a professor, one time at New Paltz, somebody visited upon my president as a state senator and a county leader and demanded I get fired. I often think that that may be the one time I've seen tenure used for what it was supposed to be used for. And the president said, I can't do that. He's, you know, he's tenured. But I wanted to get somewhere else with you. One of the things that you've done, you are an expert in where people who want to put money into the environment should go. And you advise people where they should spend their money, foundations and others, where they should spend your money. How did all that start?
Well, I got, again, lucky. Cousteau, it was such a 360-degree perspective that I acquired with him. As I said, everybody wanted to meet him. Everyone was in some level of awe of what he stood for. And so I was able to sort of see where breakthroughs needed to be. And with all this experience with these conferences, and as I said, Paris was a great deal of redundancy, I believe that if we added up all the person hours that have been spent on climate change since 92 by everybody around the world, conferences, policies, debates, discussions, you probably are into potentially hundreds of years of time, human time spent on this discussion of the problem. And so that's something we should also seriously question, is why we spend so much time and for so little result. So the advising of where to put money comes from a sense of where the breakthroughs are and where are some of those. As I said earlier, discussion of the employment possibilities, the environmental movement has completely missed that boat. And all the money spent on environmental organizations, how come we haven't been able to really get across the idea that it's a jobs program to build up and make infrastructure resilient to climate change, invent new things. That's about employment. The gap between employment and environment is still quite profound. And if I were running a foundation now or had money to spend, I'd be talking to unions. I'd be building up unions. I'd be doing a tremendous amount of outreach with people who stand to gain from environmental.
But Paula, why do they come to you and say, look, we know we should be green, but we don't really know exactly where to put the money? You are now the expert in how to do that.
Well, they come to to me because I think I have a certain amount of perspective. So what I say is you have to look for breakthroughs. Where's the bottlenecks? The bottlenecks are in constituencies. We have all the usual suspects all the time. So who has been missing are the industrial players who stand to gain, who are employed, who work. So anything to do with getting them engaged and helping them understand and training them for the jobs of the future, that's where I'd put some money.
Well, they went to liberal arts colleges. How come they don't know?
Well, they didn't go to necessarily liberal arts
some
colleges.
Did.
Well, some did. But, you know, they got dropped. This has been one of the things that didn't gel. So we need to regel that. And the other thing about philanthropy is this idea of Wall Street, to go back to the idea that there needs to be education among the managers of money about environmental issues. Now, you could say, well, is it the role of philanthropy to educate people who manage money? And I would say, to an extent, yes. And that's one of the things we've been doing at the Carbon Disclosure Project, which I'm advising. What they do is they send out a questionnaire every year to all the publicly traded companies in the world. They've been doing it since 2000. They send that out over the signature of most of the financial service sector organizations in the world. And information comes back, which is then goes into a database and into reports. And so the internal decision-making processes of companies becomes exposed to scrutiny, and Wall Street has sort of picked up on that. Now, we've been running seminars where we are educating money managers and public policy people about what I was saying earlier, this greening of the economy, that you can make money. You certainly will not lose money, but you can probably make a significant amount of money by shifting your investment lenses towards green things, which is surprisingly not a common thought. It is still quite a boutique. It's not a boutique practice. It's become more mainstream. But the idea of using money to address climate change is not something that is intuitive to the business world. And so there could be a role to play in educating them to bridge these gaps. It's all about gap bridging now. It's not about inventing new information. It's about educating people who have power about where to apply their power.
But, of course, you have power. You have personal power by making decisions as to this as opposed to that.
Right. Well, I try to be reasonable, and I wish I had more power when it comes to that. But, you know, giving away money is not that easy because there's a lot of people clamoring for it. And
exactly.
What was that?
I think some people get it too easily. I worked for a place called the Eagleton Institute of Politics back at Rutgers years and years ago. And my director had absolute access to the Ford Foundation people. And I thought of all of those people who filled out 100-page requests. This guy would walk in and somebody would say to him, we've got so much set aside for you. At least that's what he told me. Got so much set aside for you. Just tell us where you're going to use it this year. And then you got all these people filling out 50-page, 100-page applications. That's got to be difficult.
Well, inbreeding is death to any organism, and that's true of philanthropy, too. You know, inbreeding, too much access, too much familiarity, that's not good. On the other hand, if you have a track record and you have delivered results and the results are evident, then why not continue to support the organization?
But what if you don't have a track record?
No track record, no more money. That's as simple as that. I mean, I think that why should there be a free pass because you're a nonprofit? I mean, there are too many nonprofit organizations at the moment. There's too much repetition and redundancy. As I say, go back to the Paris, you know, there were hundreds of people at that conference, thousands of media. I mean, the output was important, but it didn't necessarily warrant 2 weeks of nonprofit attention where every little pin that was dropped, you know, had a reverberation of analysis. So, you know, I think that, you know, everything needs to be thinned out and focused and refocused, and that includes the nonprofit sector.
What would you do?
Well, certainly I would.
To refocus the not-for-profit sector.
Well, I mean, I think you continually bring your staff together and ask them what their frustrations are. What is it that they're trying to do that they're not getting done? You bring in the grantees and you put everything on the table. So what can we be doing for you that we're not doing? You know, just open the dialogue. I mean, right now, one of the problems with philanthropy that's frightening is that increasingly foundations are not accepting proposals. If you go on many websites of foundations, it says no unsolicited proposals accepted. So this, again, goes to inbreeding. Who are they? How do you make a proposal if you can't send one in, if you have to be invited to send one in? It's not a cocktail party that you need to be invited to. This is public money. So you need to, I think, one, open a dialogue and get much more freshness into the system. Two, you start asking people outside of the sphere what they think about the nonprofit sector. And, you know, maybe we look at a whole new structure for funding. Maybe tax deductions are great, but what about selling shares in nonprofits? What if we could all buy shares in a nonprofit, invest in them? And I'm going to be working on that. I'm very fascinated with that idea, because then you could potentially assign a value to the social product that's created by a nonprofit that's not dependent on this supplication model. Because just as inbreeding is terrible, so is supplication. Who wants to be a beggar? And I had grantees when I was at the Joyce Foundation who would come in and they would take credit for, you know, good weather. You know, they thought they had to prove to me that all good came from them. Whereas what I wanted to hear from them was, what have you been unable to accomplish and why? And how can I help you get to that? Tell me what your bottlenecks are and how can I help you break through those? Not, don't tell me what you've done that was relatively doable. The doable's done. Let's talk about now what the next thing is.
You know what drives me crazy? You're really touching on something very important for not-for-profits, and you're the right person to ask about this. But I think there are assumptions. Assumption. Give to National Public Radio because they get to all over the country. But don't give necessarily, although sometimes they do, to stations like this one, the 29 frequencies, and have all kinds of environmental shows and things, or a show about women, 51%, that nobody else has. And you say, okay, then how come? Because there's a set way of thinking that NPR is the big player and that the local stations, whether it's NYC, or do get some grants, and WMC would also get some grants. But they used to say that the 50 states are the laboratories of democracy. But that's true also here. So it makes me, and I'm giving you my problem, crazy to sort of think about this and why there's an automatic assumption that the big dog is the only dog.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, again, human nature. And I think that's why it's very important to have local foundations, community foundations. You know, as you well know, all politics is local. People relate to people they know. And upstate New York is not rich in, it's not rich, period, but it's certainly not rich in this idea of community foundations. They're relatively small. And maybe community foundations are relatively small in upstate New York. And maybe what needs to be done is an outreach to the big players, including you, and back to lobbying and saying, look, you know, can you endow a couple of local foundations? Maybe, you know, let's take the Gates Foundation, which came on the scene about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, with an awful lot of money. You know, they could have actually put their money into other foundations. And I was exploring the model of re-granting, where the Gates Foundation would have given, because in Chicago, there were a number of foundations already working on public schools. It was a significant amount of money already invested in public education, which is a whole other topic. But the Gates Foundation could have invested in the existing foundations and just helped replenish the portfolios and the grant-making capacity of the existing organizations. Was it necessary to actually create another foundation? So this is another model that not everybody needs a foundation in their own name. And this goes back to the tax laws. Everybody's, if you're only doing the philanthropy for tax deduction purposes and because you have a sense of higher responsibility, but your rewards come through the tax system, then you tend to favor people who want to continue getting tax benefits as opposed to monetizing or putting a value on the other benefits, which would enable more people to understand that value.
Well, Paula DiPerna, with all you've done, I thank you so much for giving us this time. I know it wasn't easy to get before these microphones, and we appreciate the great effort that you've put into it. And when you come back the next time, we'll continue the conversation. Thank you so much. We've been in conversation with Paula DiPerna, a strategic, environmental, and philanthropic policy advisor and writer who currently serves as a special advisor in North America for the Carbon Disclosure Project, CDP. Paula, again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.